John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center. www.imemc.org for Monday, August 2nd, 2010. Israel agrees in principle to a UN probe of the flotilla fiasco, and tit-for-tat attacks continue between Hamas and Israel. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The top seven ministers in Israel's cabinet decided that it should participate in the UN's international probe into the attacks on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla at the end of this past May. The agreement to participate would be a number of firsts for the State of Israel. It would mark the first time they had participated in international examination of the activities of its military, as well as the first time that they would be represented on a committee dealing with its activities. Israel will continue to negotiate the finer details and process of any investigation, and the full international investigation will likely only come after internal investigations by separate Turkish and Israeli committees are completed. Rocket fire hit the home of a member of the Hamas movement in Deir al-Balah refugee camp, central Gaza, injuring 42 civilians. There were no deaths. Medical sources in Gaza have claimed that the State of Israel is the source of the attack. Israel is denying any involvement. Also early Monday morning around 8 a.m., five rockets were launched from the Egyptian Sinai eastward. They hit the southern Israeli port of Eilat and its neighboring Jordanian city of Aqaba. Four men in the Jordanian city of Aqaba were wounded, one critically. The critically injured man succumbed to his wounds and passed away later in the day. No injuries were reported in Eilat. Israel also abducted 11 civilians throughout the West Bank in the early morning hours. The civilians were from Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, Hebron, and Tubus. Israeli forces also destroyed the land of a Palestinian farmer in Al-Bakah village, who is also a leader in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Soldiers upturned the land of Badrin Jaber, destroying current plantings and its irrigation Monday morning. They also beat and detained two of his relatives after trashing his home. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Afghanistan, Sunday. Two British soldiers were killed, one by an IED, one by small arms fire, a according to the British military. Afghanistan, Sunday. Several NATO troops were injured in a hard landing of a helicopter in Kunar. As usual, the Taliban claims to have shot it down, and NATO denies it. Lots of helicopters crashing, though, just like the problems the Russians had with their Mi-24 gunships being blasted from the skies. There are reports in the WikiLeaks treasure trove that the very same Stinger missiles first supplied to Afghans by the U.S. in the 1980s have been used for this purpose again. Afghanistan. The Netherlands is withdrawing from the war, a war that led to the replacement of that country's governing coalition. This comes as the war is heating up, and occupiers are taking more and more losses. Just like in Iraq, a few years ago, America's coalition partners are bailing out one by one, fleeing defeat, like rats leaving a sinking ship. Just as July was the deadliest month in the history of the Afghan War for the U.S., so it was the deadliest month for Iraqis at home since May 2008, with a reported 535 people killed in the fighting. Half of all U.S. troops are leaving this month, but all insurgent groups are staying, meaning they have won and the U.S. has lost. Meanwhile, the fighting goes on. Kut, Iraq, today. Two bombs exploded near a gold market, killing at least 15 people and leaving dozens wounded. The first blast was from a roadside bomb. The second was a car bomb, like the one in New York, except that it actually detonated. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Five more police officers were killed in unspecified attacks. Iraq, today. Two police officers and an Iraqi soldier were killed in other attacks. Al Anbar Province, Iraq, Monday. An Iraqi cop's house was blown up before dawn, killing him, his wife, and four-year-old daughter, hospital and police officials reported. Seven other family members, including four of the policemen's sons, were wounded in the blast. Baghdad, Sunday. Three Iraqi soldiers and a civilian bystander were killed, and 11 people were injured in a bomb attack in Rashid on the southern outskirts of the capital. A first explosion caused no casualties, but it was followed by a second explosion when security forces responded, causing the casualties. Baghdad, ongoing. Iraq has not been able to form a government since the disputed Florida-style elections last spring. This was supposed to be a key test of the success of the U.S. occupation. Iraqi National Alliance will not support Nouri al-Maliki for prime minister. The deadlock between Maliki and Alawi, both supported by occupation troops in the past, continues. Many in Iraq see no resolution prior to fall, with people stockpiling food and money against what many fear, quote, could turn worse in 2006 and 2007. Mr. Barack Obama, now is the time to pull the plug on these senseless wars of occupation. Bring all the troops home today. Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. On the 29th of July, a court injunction stopped what would have been the first day of enforcement of Arizona's racist, Nazi-authored SB 1070 immigration law. Protesters blockaded at least one jail in Arizona. In Phoenix, they marched on the offices of racist Sheriff Jerry R. Powell. And in Tucson, Arizona, protesters blockaded and shut down the whole center of the city with a variety of direct actions. People were wearing t-shirts saying, "We will not comply," and backed it up with direct action. Tires, tar, and broken glass were used to shut down I-19, an interstate used for deporting immigrants. The entire downtown area was shut down by protesters. One group of protesters hung a banner from a crane reading, "Stop Hate." The banner also circle slashed the letters SB 1070 and 287G, the latter being the infamous program where local cops work in conspiracy with ICE to enforce immigration laws.
Stop Hate.
Yep. The police could not arrest the protesters on the crane until they returned to the ground, at one point resorting to verbal harassment or the sound system on a helicopter. At the end of the day, after a storm of protests that racist Sheriff Jerry R. Powell had to indefinitely suspend his planned raids on all Latino neighborhoods.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses.
In anticipation of hosting future rounds of the World Cup and Summer Olympics, Rio de Janeiro police have launched a campaign to forcefully retake the favelas or poor urban slums that ring the city. According to The Nation magazine, a police helicopter was shot down last October during a firefight between police and rival criminal gangs. Three police officers and 12 civilians were killed in the incident. Typically, police enter a favela using deadly force in quick, brutal raids, but then just as quickly leave. However, under a new pacification program, the Brazilian government is planning to set up permanent outposts in the favelas and bring in social services such as healthcare and education to benefit the population living in these extremely poor slums. But police may have a hard time gaining the trust of favela dwellers. Human Rights Watch reports that Rio police officers killed more than 1,100 civilians every year, but only a handful of cops have been convicted of abuses over the last decade.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
On the 29th of July, at Award One Candidates Forum, held by a number of D.C. progressive organizations in the True Redeemer building, D.C.'s Ward One council member Jim Graham showed up late, insulting the groups that put on the candidates forum by doing so. Once Jim Graham arrived, his speeches were long on blowing his own horn, but often concealed the extent of his own deal-making with developers at the expense of the people.
Question number 8. Number of homeless families in D.C. continues to grow, and families are overcrowded at the D.C. General Shelter.
Yeah, thanks to the closure of Franklin Shelter in downtown D.C.
Many other families are on a wait list for service or are living on Mr. Graham. And what are your plans for a shelter in Ward 1 if the CASA closes? Please answer this question, please.
Thank you very much for this question. You know, the fact of the matter is that low barrier shelters, such as at La Casa, you know, are very important, but they can't be the whole answer.
Back in 2004, Councilmember Jim Graham cast a deciding vote to close Randall Shelter so the building could be given to the Corcoran Gallery of Art. This shelter was also deemed too close to the baseball stadium. This was a 3-2 vote in committee, and Jim Graham was the undecided vote until he voted with the developers to close Randall Shelter.
Because the fact of the matter is we've got to move people into single-room occupancies, which is known as SROs. I support the mayor's efforts to do that, which is happening right now at La Casa. I support the efforts, which will also give people their own apartments, which happened at D.C. Village, where D.C. Village was an absolute nightmare. Until we stepped in and we said, we want you to have your own apartments. We don't want this kind of family, low barrier shelter.
There's just one problem with Finney's Housing First plan, and that is that a lot of people who were thrown out of Franklin Shelter when it closed and given an apartments promptly lost those apartments and are now back on the street.
We're still going to need low barrier shelters, and for that reason, I support the move of Central Union Mission to the Gale School at 65 Massachusetts Avenue. I worked hard to have that happen. It's finally happening. They're not going to 3512 Joyce.
And now one of Mr. Graham's primary opponents responds.
There is no space in any of the family shelters that we're using DC General as a spot to house families should be a black letter that we're wearing on our vest, because that's the hypothermia center. So if we continue with double-digit unemployment into the winter, and we have a winter that was like last year, where do we send people who are suffering from hypothermia living physically on the streets? We have no space. So the question that I want, and I'm completely for moving people into long-term goals, trying to get them into apartments, trying to get them into home ownership, trying to create new subsidies to create more public housing. But the question I have is, all of these programs that are looking to the future, why do we close the Randolph School? Why would we close a shelter at a time that we are critically in need of bed space for families, for women, for children, for fathers, who are out actively looking for jobs every day, and they're forced to live in the hypothermia center at DC General? This is our crisis at this time, and we need to find something immediately to do that. So I would suggest that any of these schools that we have that are not being, we need to retrofit them specifically right now for families while we have this double.
Like Franklin?
Jim Graham didn't give straight answers to somebody asking him about libraries either.
But it
does Mr. Graham have to say about the library situation?
Well, he pulls out normal stuff that he's had umpteen number of meetings. But unfortunately, he never points out the fact that even his compromise was thrown off the table by DCPL and DC Public Library, and that the fact that these meetings, you can have 1,000 meetings, but if the community's voice isn't listened to, what's the point of them?
So Mr. Graham, basically, his response is, I had this meeting and I had that meeting?
Right. And he's claiming that the ramp is ADA compliant. We don't know how they changed the plans. Last, they were not ADA compliant. So somehow he has inside knowledge. And he also pointed out that the chief made some fire report claiming that this project is okay. But it's clearly going to block access off of Lamont Street, which is about access to about 1,000 people. And one of the buildings in Deauville burned dead into the ground.
Yeah, landlord arson.
Right, and the fire department couldn't get back there readily. This will make it worse. The fire department has never had a discussion with any of these surrounding neighbors in 2.5 years.
This is convenient for those who want to burn out the rest of the community up there, isn't it?
It does make it more convenient. I hate to say that. And it's sad because it's just not necessary. This is an opportunity to increase access. Instead, we're seeing a decrease for seniors and residents with disabilities, and we're seeing a decrease for the safety of the residents living around the library.
Too. I'm giving people $100 to put yard signs in their yard.
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington.
There is unrest in the forest. There is trouble with the trees. For the maples want more sunlight.
In a world of corporate domination and utter ruin, whosoever shall have the courage to take direct action against those who are ruining our planet and our very lives. After 3 months of BP's oil spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, in the middle of the hottest July ever recorded in D.C., the Washington Post is reporting that SUVs in Glover Park had their tires flattened. On Thursday night, the 22nd of July, a number of SUVs in Glover Park received flat tires. Even the head of the Glover Park Citizens Association had her tires flattened. Police are speculating that the damage was ecologically motivated, according to the Washington Post. Do elves walk among us even today, striking out against global warming and BP's oil spill in Glover Park? On the same night, 7 or 8 vehicles in Loudoun County, Virginia, had their windows smashed, though the cops are saying that this is less likely to be the work of pro-Earth guerrillas. Just imagine this. You just spent $100,000 buying a like-new Hummer. You said, to hell with sharing the road, and to hell with Earth. One morning, you wake up, 4 flat tires, all your windows broken, and the 3 magic letters, ELF, keyed into your paint. Your insurance says,
FBI calls ELF terrorism, and we don't cover terrorism.
Do elves of the ELF walk among us here in D.C.? The Washington Post and area law enforcement don't know, but with BP's oil spewing for so long, and this summer's record heat, there may be a hell of a lot of people who don't like seeing selfish urban SUV drivers right now. I have a feeling the police face yet another fruitless investigation, uselessly chasing elves. On the 27th of July, Greenpeace succeeded in shutting down every single BP gas station in London. In the hours before the stations would open, covert action teams visited every single one of them, removing fuel safety switches, without which the gas pumps cannot be turned on. Some of the stations remained closed all day, with a BP spokesman predicting that they would, quote, reopen by evening, while a few reopened more quickly, and BP suddenly claimed Greenpeace had missed a few stations. The emergency shutoff switches are also used on gas stations in the U.S. If they are removed, the wires to turn the pumps on are effectively disconnected, same as turning off the switch. The difference is that turning the pumps back on requires installing a replacement switch, and these may have been in short supply, leaving most BP stations closed for the day. Greenpeace said the protest was being held to encourage BP's new CEO, who is replacing Tony Hayward, to move away from his predecessor's obsession with high-risk, environmentally reckless sources of oil. At one station in Camden, North London, Greenpeace climbers replaced BP's logo with a new version showing the green sunflower disappearing into a sea of oil. Elsewhere, protesters put up signs saying, quote, closed, moving beyond petroleum. Greenpeace said, the moment has come for BP to move beyond oil. Indeed it has. The massive Gulf oil spill has proven beyond all possible doubt that the safety of our waters cannot be left in the hands of BP or the other oil companies. When profits and cost-cutting govern such dangerous work, accidents become an inevitable cost of cheap oil. What BP does in the Gulf of Mexico, Shell does in Nigeria, so they too need to be shut down or at least nationalized, as do all the rest of the multinational resource extraction barons. Never forget those oiled pelicans. Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. Never mind our blown-out oil well in Macondo, in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway. On the 27th of July, the Animal Liberation Front brought the flames of liberation to Yapelto's fur farm in Astoria, Oregon. Owner Henry Pelto woke up to the sound of explosions in the night, finding structures and farm equipment in flames in both the front and rear of the property. Since ALF never burns buildings containing the living, the fur farmer's home was spared. Only his chances to keep murdering animals for the skins off their backs went up in flames. The owner is now claiming that he shut the fur farm down in December 2009 after two prior visits from the Animal Liberation Front. He could well be lying, as this information has not been heard before by animal rights activists.
No more lights, no more lights. Fire.
That's right. No more lies. Blood and fire. Fire has been visited upon those who have spilled so much blood. Assuming the farm is shut down for good now, this is the second fur farm in Oregon the ALF has been able to shut down by force. The SNN fur farm in Scio, Oregon was found to be empty in a summer 2009 investigation as part of the Fur Farm Intelligence Project. That farm was raided by the ALF in September 2008. Astoria is the largest mink farming town in Oregon, home to not five known mink farms and another possible one that is unconfirmed. Of course, if animal rights insurgents keep taking these fur farms out, that could soon change.
No more nights, blood and fire. No more nights, blood and fire. Oh, no more nights. Oh, no more nights.
Well, DNA is natural, it's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Most people don't think much about the significance of seeds, but one speaker at the March 6 conference of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA, maintains that seeds are responsible for the development of civilization itself, because food crops enabled humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to farmers, leading to settled communities and the growth of cities. Ken Green is the founder of Hudson Valley Seed Library, based in the village of Accord, New York. During a workshop at the NOFA conference, Green examined the history of seeds, which for millennia were saved from one year's harvest and planted the next. But with the growth of giant multinational conglomerates like Monsanto, the life of seeds has changed dramatically. When companies patent hybrid seeds, they become private property, which means saving them for the next season becomes illegal. Now, farmers and gardeners are forced to purchase new seeds every year from giant corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Green about the history of seeds, the role of private enterprise, and the fight back in the form of seed exchanges and seed banks.
One of the challenges that we've taken up with the Hudson Valley Seed Library is that, you know, food security has become this big buzzword. You know, how are we going to feed people? How are we going to make sure that communities can provide food for themselves? Food, which right now is distributed over many, many miles, how can we be more regional about it? And feed more people. And it's interesting to see that for some people the answer, they're talking about GMOs. When of course with a GMO, it's illegal, they're patented, it's illegal to save your own seed. So if we can't save our own seeds from the plants that we're growing to plant them again, how is that a secure food system? And how is that a sustainable food system? It's not. Because we have to rely on the technology and profit-driven motives of a multinational corporation to dictate what can be grown and how it's grown. And we have to get seed from them every year, and it's expensive seed. So when I started the seed library and I was trying to encourage people and get them to start trying to save seeds on their own, and I started realizing that along with losing the genetic diversity, which is so important, by becoming more dependent on hybrids and GMOs, that we're also losing the seed-saving skills. So many people were saying to me, but I don't know how to do this. And if we lose the skills, then we lose our ability to be self-sufficient in terms of food production. So you know, that's why when we're offering seeds through the seed library and through our online catalog, that everything we offer is open pollinated. And we don't offer any hybrids, and certainly we don't offer any GMOs, so that people can save their own seeds. And we're running the library part of it. It's participatory, so that people can save their own seeds, send them back to us, and then we can mix them with the other seeds that come back from other seed library members and then send them back out, so that we're all sharing the genetic diversity and that we're all cooperating to make sure that we are in charge of our own food sources.
Ken Green, you were talking at the workshop about how multinational companies are basically raiding the seeds that are used by indigenous peoples. Can you say more about that?
Well, this is there's sort of a word to describe it now. It's called biopiracy. And it's basically for plant breeding, the more genetic material you have, the better. Because you never know what you're going to be looking for as pests and disease change, as climate changes, as what crops become more important or less important change. It's important to have sort of a full palette, genetically speaking, to work with. So, you know, it's not just now. For ages and ages, people have been traveling and finding new plants and collecting seed from them to have, you know, a seed bank, whether it's a government or a corporation. But what's happening now, the thing that's really changed about it is that corporations have really been pushing to be able to patent genes. And it started with the GMOs in terms of they were actually inserting technology, you know, technologically changing the genetic makeup of something, and so they could patent that. But what's happening now is there's, you know, a lot of movement and pressure from corporations that they want to be able to patent existing genetic makeups or existing single genes even. So they can go to whatever culture they want to where they see something that they think might be useful. They take the seeds and then they say, we want to patent it, but they're not recognizing that it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years breeding work on the part of whatever culture they're taking that seed from that created that genetic makeup. So it was really somebody else's work. So why should they be able to patent it, you know, as a quote-unquote discovery when it exists because it exists within a culture and because of the work of a certain culture?
You have your seed libraries. There are other seed exchanges and seed banks. Is seed saving something that's growing, so to speak, and that might combat some of the negative tendencies we just talked about?
You know, I think on a grassroots level, in terms of home gardeners, saving seed and sharing seed with each other in any form, you know, even if it's just between neighbors or family or, you know, at your community center, it doesn't have to be a library or a bank or anything official. I think it's really important work for communities and important for us to be sharing those seed resources on a larger scale in terms of what's happening more globally. I think there are more organizations, non-governmental organizations, getting involved in these issues. But one of the things that we were talking about at the conference was that just because it's called a seed bank or a seed library or a seed exchange, there's no specific definition of those entities, so everyone does it differently. And there's something great about that in that you can tailor it to your community and to the people who are involved, but you also have to really look into it to see, like, what, you know, what does it mean? Who's benefiting from this? Who's behind this? What is it really for?
That was Ken Green of the Hudson Valley Seed Library. For more information, visit the group's website at seedlibrary.org.
Stanford University historian Robert Proctor, an expert on the history of tobacco, was shocked in 2009 to receive court papers accusing him of witness tampering and witness intimidation. He was also served a subpoena seeking the historian's unfinished book manuscript. According to The Nation magazine, Proctor got another subpoena demanding 3 years of email correspondence with another historian and his computer hard drive. These actions are part of tobacco giants R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris's efforts to prevent Proctor from testifying as an expert witness in Florida civil cases. Proctor is one of only two professional historians who testify on behalf of smokers with cancer against big tobacco companies in civil cases, while there are 40 other academics who regularly testify in support of tobacco companies. The harassment of Proctor and other experts who fight big tobacco is the latest chapter in ongoing litigation over the health consequences of smoking. In 1998, states' attorney generals agreed to a $246 billion settlement with big tobacco to pay for past health care expenses caused by smoking. Later, the Clinton administration filed a massive suit against tobacco companies. Now, civil cases are sprouting up in Florida, where the state Supreme Court disbanded a huge class action suit against tobacco companies. After months of hearings and the order to turn over his emails, the court found that Proctor did nothing improper. Florida courts also sided with Proctor in protecting his unpublished manuscript, saying the historian has the constitutional right to choose when and where his writings are published.